From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's been another day of dramatic testimony in the fraud and tax evasion trial of former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort, with former business partner Rick Gates continuing his testimony against Manafort. Gates struck a deal with Robert Mueller's Russia investigation to cooperate with prosecutors after he pled guilty to conspiracy and false statements. He's now the star witness, as one paper wrote, laying out a tutorial on shell companies and illegal business practices. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas has been watching. Ryan, Gates laid out so many sordid details yesterday, including admitting he stole from Manafort, embezzled. But so what more did we learn today?
Well, over the past week or so, we've heard from bookkeepers and accountants. We've seen loan applications and emails. Now the jury is hearing from Gates, the inside man who was, you know, played a crucial role in all of this. And organizing and taking part in the wire transfers and what the government alleges is bank and tax fraud. So we've heard from Gates, basically, as you said, it's almost like a tutorial in questionable business practices. He talked about creating loan documents for loans that didn't exist, talked about how he had foreign bank accounts from bookkeepers and tax accountants and ultimately the U.S. government, talked about wiring money to businesses in the U.S. from secret bank accounts overseas. And he talked about how he did all of this at Paul Manafort's direction. Yeah. He said that he was in frequent contact with Paul Manafort the whole time. He was aware of all of the details of all of this. And that in the case of the foreign bank accounts and loans, they were doing this to try to hide income and lower Paul Manafort's taxes. And we got a little taste in an email today of how Paul Manafort reacted to this. And it was an email from Manafort to Gates in which Paul Manafort was very upset about the tax bill. And he described it as a disaster and said that they need to discuss options basically for ways of lowering Manafort's tax bill.
This is an email that was read out in court.
An email that was displayed in court as an exhibit, yes.
Well, Rick Gates is testifying, as we said, under a plea deal. He's already pled guilty to, you know, false statements, conspiracy. He's admitted over the course of all of this, the, you know, committing crimes. So what do you think the defense is going to be? Are they going to maybe use that as undermining his testimony to say, well, you're just saying this to get off from the things that you did?
Well, that's actually the argument that they laid out in their opening statement. They went directly after Gates's credibility. They pinned all of the problems that Manafort has at the moment really at Gates's feet. They said that Gates stole from Manafort, that Gates abused Manafort's trust. And we definitely expect for them to pursue those themes in the cross-examination when we get to that point this afternoon. Now, the prosecution has done its job in trying to present to the jury enough evidence to push back against those arguments by showing that Manafort was indeed CC'd on emails regarding his tax preparations and getting documentation and showing evidence that Manafort was, you know, he was the boss. He was the man who was directing this.
Yeah. Look, this is all part of Mueller's Russia investigation. These payments came from Russia-backed Ukrainians. But this was a string that got pulled and really, in many ways, has nothing to do with Russian interference in the U.S. election, except some critics are pointing out, well, Paul Manafort went and worked for Donald Trump when he had nothing. He had gone through all the money and he took a job for nothing. So some people are speculating why that happened. But why else is what we're seeing now important?
Well, I mean, this is the first trial to come out of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference. And so people are paying attention to it to a large extent because of that, as kind of a bellwether of whether Mueller can get a guilty verdict, how juries are going to respond to this. But as you noted, this is not a case that revolves around the question of Russian interference. This is a bank and tax fraud case about Manafort's business dealings from about 2005 to 2015. And that is the focus. We have not heard a lot about we haven't heard anything about President Trump, and we've heard very little about Russia.
Yeah. How much is the prosecution counting on Gates' testimony to convict Manafort? You know, how weakened would they be if the defense does get to discredit him?
Well, Gates' testimony is certainly central to the prosecution, but it's not everything. As I said earlier, you know, they've had tax accountants come in and testify about making, you know, changes to loan documents that they knew to be false, about the role that Manafort played, how he was hands-on, how he was very detail-oriented, how he approved of every penny in the way that it was spent. There are documents detailing how Manafort did not check a box to declare foreign bank accounts. And the prosecution has gone through with several witnesses showing that indeed Manafort did control foreign bank accounts. So Gates provides an inside look and gets to question of what Manafort was thinking. But does the whole case rest on Gates? No, it does not. The prosecution has done a lot to bring all of that together.
Ryan, we just have a couple seconds. What's it like in the courtroom when we hear Manafort is glaring at Gates?
That's right. So Gates, when Gates took the stand yesterday, he did not look at Manafort. Manafort was indeed staring at Gates the whole time, and that has continued today. But it's a dramatic moment for sure, having former business partners testify.
NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas, thank you.
Thank you.
Good thing they have lunch breaks so that we can get Ryan out to talk about what's happening in the case.
Right.
Well, we've been following the destruction in California caused by 16 major wildfires. There are also large fires in Colorado, but weekend rains there have helped firefighters trying to contain them. Like much of the West, Colorado's wildfire season is getting longer and more destructive. And when the fires are in remote places that fire trucks can't reach, an elite crew of smoke jumpers are called to parachute in. Colorado Public Radio's Michael Elizabeth Sackis went to learn more about the dirty and dangerous job.
So, you know, I got here yesterday, so I'm just kind of getting my feels around here. So,
at the Grand Junction Air Center, Chelsea Koff gives me a tour of her new base camp.
We can jump at higher wind speeds with these parachutes.
Koff is a smoke jumper in her third fire season. She wears a flat brim hat. Her long blonde hair hangs to the side in a loose fishtail braid. She's specially trained to parachute into remote areas with 80 pounds of gear to fight wildfires in their early stages. In her personal bag is a small tent, a toothbrush, food, and water. She has to be self-sufficient for 72 hours once she hits the ground.
We try to be really low maintenance, try to get the job done, try to put out these tiny fires without having to call in a lot of support. The rest of the region's working on usually big incidents, and they don't want to have to deal with these smaller things. That's kind of our responsibility.
Without those extra resources, the smoke jumpers fight the flames by creating a fire line by hand. They cut down trees, clear flammable material, and dig a border down to the dirt to keep the fire from being able to spread. Koff says even once the flames are out, the team usually stays overnight to keep an eye on the situation.
We'll actually get down on hands and knees and kind of climb through the dirt just to feel around and make sure that fire is not getting down into the root system, because that can happen often and then it'll rekindle, especially with the winds that we're getting down here that can push fires and just reignite.
And if the smoke jumpers need to stay longer, supplies are dropped in to keep them supported for a week or more. On the tarmac sits the plane. It's stocked with food and tools that are thrown out the door along with a team of jumpers. Rudy Schlesing is the pilot of the de Havilland Twin Otter.
It's really the perfect airplane for a smoke jumper operation because it can carry a lot of weight at very slow speed.
Schlesing says the slow speed lets jumpers land more accurately, and the plane can take off and land in the backcountry with little runway. He says he's been flying this plane for a long time, that he can do it with his eyes closed. But this is his first fire season, and he says it's been challenging.
Now I got 9 fires behind me, so I'm pretty confident on what I'm doing.
Koff and her team were brought in from Montana to Colorado as extra support for the region's busy fire season. This fire management unit also covers parts of Wyoming and Utah. And if a fire is too hard to control from the ground, smoke jumpers can call in reinforcements, more firefighters, or planes to drop retardant. Jake Lloyd is the assistant air tanker base manager.
Normally we kind of nickel and dime retardant and retardant drop, you know, maybe one week and two weeks later, but we started Saturday, Memorial Day weekend, and pretty much haven't stopped since, so it's kind of impressive right now.
On the wall behind Lloyd is a whiteboard with a list of all the fires the aviation crew has worked on this year, and the list is full.
Alex here is currently typing that list up so we can make a printout and erase that and start over. 2012 was our last busiest season until this year.
And it doesn't look like things will get easier. Adam Gaydon is the air tanker base manager and has been for the last 18 years. He says they have far fewer resources than they've had in the past. As planes have aged, they've been dropped from the fleet.
You know, when I started here, we had 44 heavy air tankers in the fleet, and now we're up to 18 to 20 when we bring on the call when needed. It's definitely a smaller heavy air tanker fleet and a lot more folks fighting for the resources.
Fighting for those resources, because those heavy air tankers are used across the U.S. Gaydon says some states, like California, need a lot of help.
The heavy air tankers are working year-round now. Their season starts in January and ends in December. It's hard on those guys. They do a lot of flying.
And for Chelsea Koff, that means a lot of jumping.
I think getting into wildfire was a guarantee that I would spend the majority of my time outside, and also just being able to have a big challenge.
A challenge that seems to be only getting bigger. For Here and Now, I'm Michael Elizabeth Sakis in Denver.
It is time now for a special Tribal Beats edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Georges Collinet is DJ and host of Afropop Worldwide. He joins us from Washington. Georges, welcome back to Here and Now.
Well, Jeremy, thank you very much for having me back.
And what are tribal beats?
Well, to me, what I think it is what you hear when you go in a village in Africa. And people are playing various drums, but in various ways. It could be musically, or it can be used as communication between villages to villages. You know, for instance, when I was younger, there's some French guy who came to visit us, and he got lost in the forest. So My grandfather, who is the only one who could use that talking drum, just started drumming around, and the pygmies heard it. And they could understand the Bulu language, Tam-Tam language. And they found the guy in this vast equatorial forest. That was amazing.
And so by the way, you're from Cameroon, right? So you're talking about Cameroon.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's hear some of the music so that people can get an idea of what we're talking about here. This is Franco and the orchestra OK Jazz, and I'm going to have you say the name of the piece.
Matata ya mwasi na mobali e kokiko silate, which means men and women will have always conflicts all over the world.
Bring in that percussion, they sound like they're having a good time.
Absolutely. And you know, Jeremy, the amazing part is one day Franco told me, you know, for a bassist to play music, soukous music, he has to learn how to play drums. You know, they use the bass as a drum.
And what kind of music are they playing?
It's soukous music, which is the music of what was known as Zaire, which is now today the Democratic Republic of Congo. But you know, the funny thing is that there is not really any name for music in Congo. It was mostly known as Muziki Nabiso. This is our music, period. But Franco was, of course, known for his rumba style.
Rumba, like the rumba.
Oh, yeah, same.
It's the same thing.
Same thing. I mean, it comes from Congo, like other musics that you have around. You know, tango, for instance.
Right.
But rumba was, you know, it made the round, what as I call it. It starts in Africa, goes to the Americas, and come back. And voila.
Okay, next one you've brought us is from Senegal, and these are the musicians Youssou N'Dour and Le Super Étoile de Dakar, and this is called Wow Senegal. So what style of music is this?
Well, that's mbalax, as they call
it. Say that again.
Mbalax.
Nice.
It's mbalax. Mbalax music. And you know, you heard the tama, the talking drum in there, which is this amazing little instrument that just is, you know, it's an hourglass-shaped little drum that you put under your arm, and you squeeze it with your arm. And as you squeeze it, it, of course, changes the tone of the instrument. So maybe I don't even need the instrument myself. But anyway.
And Rolling Stone called Youssou N'Dour perhaps the most famous singer alive in Senegal and much of Africa.
Well, we always think that Youssou N'Dour was our Bob Marley, because in Africa we have this thing where, well, we need a Bob Marley to really propel our music in the world and give it some. And Youssou N'Dour is getting there. He's getting us there somehow.
Okay, he's the guy. Yeah. All right, the next one is Bobe Spirits Calling. This is performed by Bayaka Pygmies.
Yes.
Now, this is from the documentary Song from the Forest about the Bayaka, which is a nomadic pygmy people who live in the Central African Republic. What can you tell us about them?
Well, first of all, they are near my village. Mm. They are, I mean, actually, my grandparents used to employ them, let's say, because they are fabulous hunters, and they would bring wild meats to the village. And they would have, of course, the protection of my grandparents. But his recordings are just amazing. And this Bobe is the djinn, I mean, the spirit of the animals that the pygmies were calling on. And it's awesome.
You can almost feel it just listening to this.
Yes.
All right. The next one is Sikiru Ayinde Barrister. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Okay, good enough. And this is called Fuji Music.
Fuji Music.
What was that sound right there? It sounded almost like a cartoon.
that's the sound of the guitar. They do it with a guitar. And they love that. Yeah.
Wow.
You know, Nigerians are amazing musicians, because they use all these new technologies to really render songs and music that are just fabulous. And Sikiru was a soldier until he decided to get into music, and he went on and created this style of Fuji music that is a little different. And it was played after the Ramadan for people to wake up, and after having fasted and all that. And they would listen to Fuji music by our friend Barry Stern.
And he, by the way, put out over 70 studio albums. He was very prolific.
Oh, yeah. Alhaji Sikuru Ayinde is very prolific. So are all the other musicians. You know, that when you see Fela has so many records it's just amazing.
Okay, well, our last one from you is also from Nigeria. This is the Nigerian drummer Babatunde Olatunji and his song Jingo Loba. That is a drummer.
Yeah.
he knows what he's doing. Ooh,
this man was amazing. You know, I heard him, it was in 1960 when I arrived in America, brand new here, and it was cold, the winter was terrible, and a friend of mine came up and he said, well, I'm going to take you, to a concert to warm you up. And it was Babatunde Olatunji and his Drums of Passion. The drumming was just amazing. Wow.
When you listen to music like this, do you find yourself just wanting to dance?
Absolutely. And Olatunji actually said, the spirit of the drum is something that you feel but cannot put your hands on. It hits people in so many different ways, but the feeling is one that is satisfying and joyful. It is a feeling that makes you say, I'm glad to be part of this world. Is that great?
Yeah, that is great. And a good note to end on. Georges Collinet, DJ and host of Afropop Worldwide. Always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And you can find all the songs we've been talking about at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
We're watching primaries in several states today and that special election in Ohio to fill the long Republican-held seat being vacated by Congressman Pat Tiberi. President Trump stumped this week for the Republican candidate Troy Balderson, casting the Democrat Danny O'Connor as a nobody, but that nobody's getting pretty close in the polls. And then Trump made those derogatory comments about Ohio native son LeBron James. Will that have an impact? Darryl Rowland is public affairs editor of the Columbus Dispatch. Darryl, President Trump today called on Ohio voters to pick Troy Balderson, the Republican, because his Democratic opponent, Danny O'Connor, is controlled by Nancy Pelosi. This was in a tweet. How is that tactic working, tying O'Connor to Pelosi?
I tell you, Nancy Pelosi's numbers here in Central Ohio must be so far underwater they're crazy, because it's been in almost every Republican ad. Troy Balderson has tried to tie in Nancy Pelosi with Danny O'Connor. Part of the reason is Danny O'Connor is a Franklin County recorder. He really has no voting record to go after. He's 31 years old. He doesn't have much of a track record. So it's almost like you have to condemn him for what he might do once he's elected.
Does he even know Nancy Pelosi?
Well, I don't know if he knows him personally. He has made it a point of disassociating himself from the minority leader and says he will not vote for Nancy Pelosi if the Democrats win back the majority and she is up for speaker. Although, frankly, one of his problems, he slipped up a little bit on Chris Matthews and said he would vote for whomever the Democratic Party puts forth, which I guess in theory would include Nancy Pelosi. But by and large, he has said, no, Nancy.
Okay, so he may not have ever met her, and he's not seeming to want to vote for her for leader if he should win. What about Troy Balderson? What is he selling about himself?
Yeah, he's selling. He has more experience, of course. He has been in our state senate, and before that as a House member. But mainly he is trying to pitch to this district, again, as you say, a very Republican district, the need to get another vote in Congress for President Trump and to carry forth his agenda.
Yeah. Well, this is a seat that was also held for 18 years by Ohio's governor, Republican John Kasich, big critic of President Trump, and came out critical of Donald Trump's comments, critical of LeBron James. Is that a factor? Are people making too much of this, the idea that President Trump got into this dust-up with LeBron James after he had an interview with Don Lemon on CNN and was slightly critical of the president? Is that going to have any impact?
I doubt it will. LeBron James is still pretty much loved, even though he has deserted us yet again. But but I don't think that's going to cut too much. I think more it's you mentioned the tweet. President also is making robocalls, recorded calls to voters in the district. Again, just being very negative on Danny O'Connor. His message is, if you care about Social Security and Medicare, Danny O'Connor is your worst nightmare. During his visit Saturday, the president was also, doing his traditional name-calling, deceptive Danny O'Connor, dangerous Danny O'Connor, and that's picked up in some of the advertising as well.
Yeah. By the way, the term they're running for today runs through January. They have to run again in November for the next two-year term. But today's race is seen as a litmus test on President Trump's strength, so we'll see what happens. Darryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks so much.
Very good. Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
And by the way, he mentioned LeBron James. Well, he, having helped open a school in Ohio, is going to L.A.
Shares of Tesla took off today after CEO Elon Musk said he's considering taking the company private. The electric car maker went public in 2010, but Musk has struggled to convince investors that he's on track to meet production numbers. Let's bring in WBUR business reporter Callum Borchers. Callum, some people thought Elon Musk was trolling his Twitter followers today when he made that announcement. What do we know so far?
Well, his follow-up tweet would seem to be a confirmation that he knew exactly what he was doing.
He just tweeted good morning with a smiley face.
Of course, his Twitter behavior has been somewhat erratic in recent months, but I think what we see here is perhaps consistent with a pattern in recent months, a second pattern, which is that Musk has been buying back Tesla stock of his own.
Mm. And is that just because he doesn't want to be accountable to investors who are looking at the production numbers and saying they're not enough?
I tell you, it sure sounded like it on the earnings call in May, right? It was sort of a memorable earnings call. And how often can you say that? They're usually quite dull. And he was very contentious, didn't like the pushback he was getting from some analysts. And I remember seeing one on CNBC afterwards saying, listen, if you don't like being accountable with these questions, well, then just take the company private. Maybe that's what he's going to do.
That's what he's doing. Okay. Tesla aside, when you look at the sales of new cars in general right now, almost every major automaker reported falling retail sales in the month of July. Ford's numbers were off 10%. Last month, it was even worse at Nissan, where sales dropped 15%. What's going on?
I think there's a few things. One, the overall numbers being dragged down by sedans in particular. So trucks and SUVs are actually going up for the most part. Gas is still pretty cheap, Jeremy, and so people don't mind buying the gas guzzlers. New car sales were up in the first half of the year, maybe spurred by the tax cuts at the end of last year. And keep in mind, too, that overall auto sales broke records the last couple of years, then finally pulled back. Maybe we're just seeing
a
correction.
Can't stay that high forever. And there's also used cars in the used car market. The CEO of Group One Automotive says his company saw record earnings last quarter because used car sales were up 11%.
Yeah, and that's sort of consistent with an industry trend. The demand for used cars are going up. In fact, the price is finally ticking back up. The Associated Press did an analysis recently showing that about $500 is the increase in the average price of a used compact this year.
That's Callum Borchers, a business reporter with WBUR. Callum, thank you.
Glad to be with you.
And if you are in the market for a used car, what should you know? Joining us now is John Linkove, who's deputy auto editor at Consumer Reports. John, welcome to Here and Now.
Jeremy, thank you for having me.
So when people go in to buy a used car, do most of them know what they're doing?
Most people don't know what they're doing, unfortunately. A lot of times people go in to buy a used car out of a desperation or a need. They go in and they buy almost what they find. You know, they go to kick the tires maybe and they drive out with a vehicle, whether it's new or used, but particularly used.
What factors determine the price of a used car?
Well, the market sets the price in the sense of the wholesale price. So it's basically supply and demand. A used car, say it's something that you own, you trade in your car, and you're buying a new car. The dealership will decide based on the wholesale market out there if they want to keep it or not. If they don't, they send it out to an auction, but mostly the mileage, the age of the vehicle, some of the wear and tear, and also just how many are out there.
One of the things that surprised me was when you look at what's out there, what's on the market, how many cars have like 130,000 miles on them, which when I was growing up, that would be a crazy amount of miles on a car. It's not really like that today, though, is it?
Well, people are holding on to their cars a lot longer. The average car is 11 years old, and that's because it's been handed a couple times. Mm-hmm. But that's also because so many more used cars are sold than new cars each year. So they're trading and they keep going.
But how much is too much when it comes to mileage?
Well, again, it depends on the reliability of the vehicle. You know, you can get plenty of vehicles that go out 200,000 miles. You know, we see from Ford Ranger pickup trucks, which unfortunately a lot of them have a Takata airbag issue going on right now, but they could be reliable. You can have a Toyota Camry that goes 200,000 miles. At the same time, you can have a car that has a lot of electronics, and at 75 to 100,000 miles, you don't want to be getting into repairs with that.
But you're saying look at the brand of the car.
Well, brand is a start, but look at the specific model. You have to start digging down. You have to use information like at ConcernReports.org, but on other sites as well, to look at reliability information.
Where do the used cars that you find at most used car dealerships come from?
Well, what you're going to see now and in the next few years, you're going to see a lot of off-lease cars. And if you see a lot of cars at used car dealerships with the 30 to 40,000 miles, that means they're off lease because car prices are so creeping, not really creeping, jumping up. A couple years ago, it was $27,500, then $29,500. Now almost $30,000 is the average new car. Hmm. It's a tough thing for people, and that's the average car. You know, you're talking a Honda Accord, Toyota Camry. We're not talking about the people who are buying BMW 3 Series, Audi A5s, et cetera. Right. But a lot of the other ones are just people trading in. Sometimes people buy a car a couple years, either they're over their head in it, they can't make the payments, or they just want something new.
What's a red flag that you would warn consumers about when they're buying a used car?
There's a lot of things. You can do the sniff test. Go in, and if it smells musty, smells oily, smells like something, you know, there's an engine problem or a water problem, something like that. Start it up. Puffs of blue smoke or white smoke out of the exhaust.
That would be a no-no.
It'd be a no-no because you're having water issues. You're having oil mixing with the fuel, you know, coolant leaks, stuff like that. One of the really good things is to go and if you're serious on a car, you get the vehicle identification number. It's called the VIN. It's on a plate in front of the driver's side window, or you can get it on the registration. If you're looking at a private sale particularly, but even at a dealer, ask them to run the VIN in their service records and see what the history of that car is. How often does the car come in and out of service? Did it bounce around? Oh my gosh, why was it at Audi of Brookline, but it was originally at Audi down in Virginia, and why was it Audi of Ohio? Not to pick on Audi, but why did this car bounce all over the place? You start wondering if it was shuttled around. You just begin to get a history of the life. So you do the sniff test, run your hands underneath the fenders, you know, look and see if the lights are fogged oddly. Mm-hmm. It's things that you
what
would notice on
your car. What
does
that tell you if the lights are fogged?
So if you see that the lights are kind of fogged, it means that there was probably a water issue, maybe a flood. So, you know, if there's a moisture, condensation that looks like it's inside the lights, avoid that.
That's
car.
A bad thing.
Yep. You know, you want to look for rust on things like screws. Look on the seats. If the seat bolts don't look like they're painted and they look new and the rest of the car looks like it's aged, seats were replaced. Why were the seats replaced? Why does the carpet seem a little different on one side? Why is there rust underneath the inside of the lips of the engine bay? Stuff like that, you begin to look and see those are problems, a big problematic car.
Will that be a problem, though, if they've made it look as good as new? If the car runs, is it a problem that the seats were replaced?
Well, you know what it is? You can have new seats and you can have new headlights, but so many computers in the car today, and a lot of the computers sit underneath the seats. The wiring runs underneath the seats. An amplifier for a stereo will be in the trunk somewhere. If it had water in there, they may replace the carpeting, but they may not have replaced the amplifier. They may have replaced the amplifier, but not all the wiring. And you start getting into those types of cascading problems. So
the dealer, you're saying, can basically dress up the car so that it seems like it's great, but then you'll find out very soon that it's not.
It could be a middleman between the dealer. Someone could buy it and then send it back out to auction. It'll be much more of a smaller lot that's going to do it. They're going to take a risk on a car that was a flood car. The flood car may be from, say, New Orleans.
Or Hurricane Harvey in Houston.
A Hurricane Harvey type car. Every time there's a huge hurricane like that, cars get bounced to other states where it's easy to wash the title. you keep titling the car. Eventually, someone misses the stamp or the stamp is very small. Then all of a sudden, it shows up in the Northeast. And it looks really great. And it's for someone who's on a budget. And it's hard for a person, you know, with a lower credit rating or who's, you know, kind of pinned against the wall budget-wise to go to a frontline dealership. So they're going to go to a secondary, a corner guy or something like that. And that's where you really run into trouble.
When a used car is certified, what does that mean?
So certified is a term to say that it's been very well inspected. The dealership has taken a risk on the car and they're going to say, well, you know what? It's pretty clean. There don't seem to be any problems with it. We're all happy to sell it because we're not going to take it back likely in a lot of warranty repairs. Mm-hmm. It's just an added bonus. It's like an extended warranty. You know, so figure the regular warranty lasts 3 years, 36,000, 4 years, 50,000 miles. This will extend the warranty. For the most part, you're going to say, these are probably pretty good vehicles, but it's good to get a certification from the manufacturer, not a third party. So if a Toyota dealership is selling a certified Camry, make sure it's certified right through Toyota and the dealership, not through a third party.
Should you haggle, negotiate with the dealer?
You absolutely should haggle as much as you can. Do your research. Look at, again, consumerreports.org has prices, ranges for cars. You can look on Auto Trader, you can look on all the different sites out there and see kind of what cars in that general mileage, price range, condition are going for. Make your offer. If you walk out and they say, no, wait, you know there's room. The best thing about used cars is that there's so many of them out there. As long as you don't fall in love with one, if it's got, you got to have it, you're going to pay for it. But if you're happy to say any Camry, any Chevy Malibu will do, you can keep looking.
John Linkov, who is deputy editor for autos at Consumer Reports. John, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And we'll post some of these tips about buying a used car at hereandnow.org.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani called the just-restored U.S. sanctions against Iran psychological warfare. The foreign ministers of Britain, France, and Germany said in a statement that they were determined to protect Europeans engaged in business with Iran from being hurt by these reimposed sanctions, which had been lifted as part of the 2015 nuclear accord, but were reauthorized today by President Trump, who decided to pull out of the deal in May. Amir Paivar, reporter for the BBC's Persian services, is in London. Amir, which sectors of Iran's economy are being affected by these sanctions?
In this round of sanctions, which took effect as of today, the Iranian car industry, the entire car industry, will be under sanctions, which means anyone in the world who sells Iran car parts or an entire automobile itself or finances these services, anything to do with Iranian car industry will be under sanctions, and that in turn means if they do business with Iran, they will be blocked from US market.
Yeah.
The same goes with selling Iran precious metals like gold and silver or steel and aluminium. It also involves providing services for Iran to be able to issue debts, that government bonds. Mm-hmm. And also, as you probably know, the licenses which were issued for Iran to be able to buy aircraft from Airbus or Boeing will be revoked as of today. Mm-hmm. Any airplane that has at least 10% U.S. manufactured components will be under these sanctions.
The sanctions will also impact Iran's ability to export things like pistachios and the famous Persian rugs. And we heard the European ministers say they were going to protect their businesses from being hurt by these sanctions. You mentioned cars, but it doesn't sound as if they trust that. We heard Daimler announce it's temporarily suspending activities in Iran because of the sanctions. So it sounds like this is going to hurt.
Yes, indeed. If you are a big multinational with a massive exposure to US market and at the same time you have a small business in Iran, it's not a difficult choice to make, quite frankly. Both of the big companies, Daimler included, Total, Siemens from Germany, announcing one by one that they will leave Iran, because at the end of the day, it's a risk and reward calculation.
Yeah.
They are more accountable to their shareholders and to their boards rather than being accountable to what the politicians in Brussels decide.
Well, the U.S. has imposed sanctions on Iran on and off since the hostage crisis in 1979. Those sanctions, as we said, were eased in exchange for Iran curbing its weapons program in that 2015 accord. And international inspectors say Iran has complied. Now, we know that the Trump administration is concerned about the sunset part of that accord, how Iran leaves that accord, that they'll just start up their nuclear weapons program again. Also very concerned about Iran's activities in the Middle East, backing groups like Hezbollah. But what will happen to Iran's economy because of these sanctions and other sanctions that might be coming in November against oil sales? I mean, what state of finances is Iran in?
Iran has been taking a hit in anticipation of these sanctions taking effect today. The Iranian currency has lost half of its value. That has triggered massive inflation. We project that inflation to be for the next year something at least 70%, which is huge. And that in turn probably will trigger recession because fluctuating exchange rates, lack of financing means Iran cannot import machinery and technology it needs, and manufacturing will suffer. Let's not forget the next batch of sanctions to snap back in November will include putting a ban on Iran's oil exports. So the US will ask all the Asian and European buyers of Iranian crude to cease buying, importing Iranian crude. Almost one third of Iranian government revenue relies on oil. A big part of the GDP relies on oil. If European and Asian refiners comply, then that means Iranian economy will be very, very severely hit.
What's the thinking about endgame here? Will Iran withdraw its support from certain crises in the Middle East? Who blinks?
I think they will raise the stakes on both sides. If it is again the same scenario as last time, Iran will continue whatever so-called malign activity it has, and then kind of both sides feel fatigue and think, well, neither the sanctions worked, let's go back to negotiating table. Probably that's what the U.S. administration is aiming for. Iranians will resist as much as they can, but given the depth and extent of how these sanctions hurt the economy, there will be a point where the Iranians will have to say, okay, enough is enough. Let's just go back and see if we can strike a new deal.
Amir Paivar, reporter for the BBC's Persian Service. Amir, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Pleasure talking to you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here Now.